Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to the Sunday Roast, Sunday the 6th of October. I'm Phil Carroll.
And I'm Kevin Hornsby.
What a busy week we've had here in Zambia, covered a good 1,000 kilometres or so as we complete our whistle-stop tour of this stunning country. What have been the highlights so far, Kev?
As usual, the food, I think. I've eaten a lot of meat.
You've been at the braai a lot, haven't you? You enjoy that.
Yeah, we had a fantastic braai in the Radisson Blue on Friday evening.
It was a game braai, wasn't it? It's something I've not really eaten a lot of in the past, but actually it was delicious, wasn't it?
Yeah, even all those sides and stuff were game. We had game lasagna, we had
game wurst.
Yeah, we had sausages, didn't we? We had picanha, we had chicken, we had
bream fish, wasn't it? A bream.
Yeah, you had the fish. Yeah, it was.
It was a proper smorgasbord, wasn't it?
Proper. It was proper. It really was. And the salads and stuff were excellent as well. So it really was good.
And I guess we've learned a lot about mining, haven't we? We've obviously, we'll talk about what we visited in a minute, but we've learned a lot about the sort of the copper processing side of things, difference between oxides, sulfides, and then not only that, but you've got the massive amount of different rocks that they're actually inside of, and how you can liberate the copper from them using the leaching processes, using flotation, and also DMS as well, which kind of uses physics, doesn't it, rather than the chemistry, because there's a lot of costs associated with acid leaching and all the different, we've seen quicklime used for flotation, but actually the DMS method is actually very, very impressive, isn't it, when you see it going through the cyclones?
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like I've been at school this week, to be honest.
Every day is a school day, isn't it?
From a copper perspective, being at school, we've visited, obviously, several mine sites. We've visited processing facilities. We've also looked, obviously, at the different types with the oxides and the sulfides, and the fact that they're easily to float off, whereas the oxides need leached. And, I mean, that is very simplistic as well, because most copper ore is made up of both things. So yeah, it has been a real education and very helpful and useful.
Good. Yeah, we'll have more on Zambia later, but let's have a look at some of the news stories that have dominated the headlines this week. Obviously, the Israel conflict continues. On Tuesday, Iran launched 200 ballistic missiles in retaliation for the death of a Hezbollah chief, while Israel claims to have intercepted many with its air defense systems. Residents of Tel Aviv and Jerusalem took to the bomb shelters as the IDF warned of consequences at a time of its choosing, with Iran threatening further attack if Israel retaliates. The assault came after Israeli troops invaded southern Lebanon in targeted raids against Hezbollah. 6 people were killed in a suspected terror attack in Tel Aviv. So, I mean, obviously, as we said, it seems to be escalating. We've seen also Israel target Russian assets in Syria, which obviously adds another dimension and brings in another country. But what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I don't know whether worrying is the right word, but it's not good, is it? It's really not good. The rogue state here is Israel. I just don't know. Nobody seems to be putting any brakes on what Israel is choosing to do. You know, to bomb Lebanon was not good, but to go ground force into Lebanon is all out war, basically. So, we're in a state. Yeah. We're in a state. What's going
to
happen?
It's got a propensity to really escalate further, isn't it? Especially, as you say, when they start in targeting Russian assets as well. You know, Russian airbase bombed. You just don't know what. You only need one or two other countries to come into this, and it's just going to go out of control. So, yeah, let's move on. So, what was decommissioned this week, 142 years after the world's first one opened? No idea. Coal-fired power station in the UK. So, basically, the UK's decision to phase out coal power, marked by the decommissioning of the last operational coal-fired power station, which is Ratcliffe-on-Soar, very close to Nottingham, by 2025. Amber Rudd, former energy secretary, reflects on this step, which aligned with conservative values of economic and environmental responsibility. She emphasises that earlier decisions to not build new coal power stations alongside pricing carbon emissions have made coal economically unviable compared to gas, nuclear and obviously renewable energy. This move is part of UK's leadership in clean energy and cutting emissions faster than other advanced economies. So I think this is a real pivotal moment in the UK as it transitions into the renewable space. The fact that, you know, you've seen coal being used for many, many, many years. And obviously it comes off the back of the announcement that they're not going to recommission the coal plant in Cumbria as well, which was obviously touted as being fired back up. But what do you make of that? Do you think this is just puts extra emphasis on the renewables? Obviously, we've got EPP who've just been, you know, seen news of this amazing loan facility. Does this just push the government into moving into these renewable projects, you think, Kev?
Yeah, I think so. And the interesting thing on Friday, there was more news, I think, for EPP. They tweeted it out as well in terms of the government stating nearly £22 billion for carbon capture projects. And that included, obviously, the hydrogen that we talked to Ben Klube about, which you will hear an excerpt from the interview later on, I think. But they were talking about Merseyside and that part of the UK in terms of gas, hydrogen, storage, reservoirs, etc., etc. So, you know, I think EPP puts itself right in the middle of all of this. I think people are just waking up now to realize that actually EPP... Yeah. At £3.5 million market cap, or whatever it happens to be right now, is looking like it's right in the middle of a thing that is going to create a lot of money coming in. Let's put it that way. So.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's move on to reason why we're down here in Zambia and give you a bit of background on Zambia itself in terms of the copper. So, according to Global Data, Zambia is the world's 10th largest copper producer in 2023, with output up by 4% in 2022. Over the 5 years to 2022, production from Zambia decreased by a compound annual growth rate of 2.68% and is expected to rise by a CAGR of 2% between 23 and 27. On August the 29th of 2024, Zambia's Minister of Mines and Mineral Development, Paul Kabuswe, launched an ambitious strategy aiming to boost the country's copper production to 3 million tonnes by 2031, some tripling of the current output. And only this week, we've seen the likes of Barrick Gold track its $2 billion super pit expansion project at the Lumwana copper mine in Zambia, with first production expected in 2028. And then obviously that expansion aims to boost annual copper output to 240,000 tonnes. We've also seen Ivanhoe Mines as well over the border. We know obviously Robert Friedland, he's expanding the exploration efforts in Zambia, aiming to replicate the success obviously in the Central African Copper Belt and in the Congo and Angola. On August the 26th, Ivanhoe signed a memorandum of understanding with Zambia's mining ministry to co-develop prospective mining projects and ensure long-term sustainable development. The agreement includes commitments from the Zambian government to provide geological data and support. Ivanhoe has also applied for an exploration license in Zambia, with plans to invest in exploration activities in partnership with the Geological Survey of Zambia. And the strategy mirrors Ivanhoe's success, as we've seen in the Kamoa Kakula copper complex in DRC. So what do you make of that, Kev? I mean, it's an ambitious number. We've talked about the 3 million tonnes. Do you think that they can get there by 2031 if the likes of Ivanhoe, if the likes of Jubilee offer their processing capabilities, and there is just a switch to turn everything on and get it going again?
No.
What realistically do you think they can do?
I think they can possibly...
1.5?
Possibly, yeah, get between 1.5 and 2 million tonnes per annum.
Yeah.
And sustain that. And yeah. That will make a dramatic difference to this country.
Yeah.
Dramatic difference. 3 million tonnes, pie in the sky, I think, to be honest. I think, you know, there is a lot of copper in Zambia. You know, for instance, in the Northwest, if they did find copper... How long is it going to take to get that copper from discovery to mine to production? What are we talking about? Probably 2030 is realistic,
yeah,
for a potential start of production. So how on earth do you expect to get to that 3 million when really the infrastructure is the problem, isn't it, in Zambia, really? The infrastructure, the roads, the power, et cetera, et cetera. So all of those are... the things that will stop Zambia going faster. It's not the copper itself.
No.
Because I think there's copper there.
Yeah, you're right. It's the infrastructure. And also the likes of, I think Mopani is a big one, isn't it, that we saw with obviously ZCCM, that the Zambian government-backed company who've gone in with IRH, the Abu Dhabi-based holdings company, to, I think if they can get that one online again and running, that would be an absolute game changer. And obviously... Barrick as well is going to be a big. So I think once these majors start moving in, you start seeing, as you say, that they're going to bring with them infrastructure changes without a doubt with their funding as well. So that, I mean, we're on the road, aren't we? We saw these massive wide loads like you've never seen, and it was like buckets for these massive earth movers that were moving that up to First Quantum, weren't they, up at the top towards the Sentinel mine. So we saw it all happening while we've been on the road.
Yeah. No, there's lots happening, but the physical ability to do all of these things, and also you're in Africa, and that's not a slur, but there is direct corruption on small scale and large scale, from the mines.
That's a good point, actually, because a lot of the
security required at the different mines,
and a lot of it goes into China as well, doesn't it? As well, you know, what I mean is if they want to produce that 3 million and put it on their books, then they're going to have to do it themselves, aren't they, and not give it to the Chinese, if that makes sense.
No, I don't think it's just Zambia, but basically the Chinese are coming here to take as much ore as they can and ship it back. I mean, we saw it, didn't we, when we went to Kabwe, that on the way there's like little villages which are Chinese villages, and they're effectively export-free zones. And, it's China.
Yeah, China in Zambia, isn't it?
China in Zambia. They bring the stuff in there, they sort it, they put it into
shipping containers.
Shipping containers, and ship it out. And they ship it out as zinc or as something.
And probably tax-free as well, right?
Yeah.
Without paying any...
It's not clever.
No.
But we're going to hear from, about stuff that we saw in Jubilee. And, I'm pretty optimistic that the amount of production that's going to come out of Jubilee. You talk about copper doubling, trebling, quadrupling. I mean, I think the copper that's going to come out of Jubilee is going to tenfold in the next 2 or 3 years. Mm. And, from a low level, granted, but I think they now have the capabilities, and it looks like going forward over the next few months, we'll see more and more announcements suggesting places that they can get more ore, protect themselves, and, they're going to have the ore, they're going to produce the copper, and then the cathodes, and also the different copper concentrates from Rowan. And that's going to be nothing but adding to Jubilee's bottom line.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the money has already been spent now.
Sure. So, as you just said, so on the Saturday just gone, we visited the Jubilee's project in Munkoyo. And on the way into site, we also stopped off at these newly built lodges, these eco lodges, where obviously staff will be based with a view to ultimately pass them on to the locals. And while we're there, we've seen that they were actually training the locals on how to build these lodges. So there's a lot of, learning, and there's a lot of knowledge being shared between the local communities. And obviously, we also saw the open pit operations ramping up with the benching ongoing and obviously stockpiling there. So we spoke to Rikus Grimbeek, MD of Zambia for Jubilee Metals, whilst on site. And so take a listen to that, to what we encountered. Okay, it's Saturday morning now, and we're heading out of Lusaka on the T2 on quite a long journey from Lusaka up to Kabwe. It's about 3 hours in total. The idea is we're heading up to Project Munkoyo, which is the new operations, or the open pit operations for Jubilee, where they're aiming for 15,000 tonnes of ore to obviously provide and feed into the Sable refinery. So what are your thoughts on it so far, Kev? Obviously, you forget how dangerous the roads are, I think, is the first thing, isn't it? The overtaking and the narrow.
It's a single-lane carriageway, which is one of the main roads in Zambia. Potholes everywhere. Huge trucks with literally thousands, maybe not thousands, but tens of tons of copper around the back of each one. Yeah, it's scary bananas. Okay, so we're heading to the Sable refinery now in Kabwe, where we will pick up Rikus, who's one of the main guys for Jubilee in Zambia. So, yeah, let's see how we all get on. And then we will head to the mine site to see what's going on.
So we're delighted to be joined by Rikus Grimbeek, the MD of Zambia for Jubilee Metals and a mining engineer with more than 30 years of experience in the mining industry. Firstly, welcome to the podcast, Rikus.
Oh, thank you very much.
So just tell us more about how Jubilee operations have advanced in Zambia in the past 12 months as it aims for a processing capacity of 25,000 tonnes of copper annually, obviously supported by the likes of Sable Refinery and Rowan Concentrator.
Yeah, that's a very long question, but it's not a very complicated answer as well. So The thing is, we've got the capacity at our Kabwe operation, the Sable operation, the refinery there. We currently have a capacity of about 600 tons of cathode a month. And we've got now at Rowan, we've got two processing units. We've got the dense media separation plant that we just commissioned about 4 weeks ago. And that can do about 50,000 tons of low-grade material through that plant. And the beauty of that plant is it actually treats low-grade mixed ores that you can then create a very good leachable concentrate from. Then we also have a flotation plant at Rowan that has got also 80 to 100,000 ton capacity. And we've been treating material there for the last 6-7 months and creating two different types of concentrate, a sulfide concentrate and an oxide concentrate. So the strategy, started around the capacity that we have. So we have the refining capacity in Kabwe and also actually flotation capacity in Kabwe. We produce about 400 to 500 tons of sulfide concentrate at our Sable operation as well at the moment. So we looked at the capacity and we said, what do we put into these refining and concentrating units so that we can optimize and get the most money out of this business? And then you overlay, I'm super passionate about sustainability and creating mining that really makes a difference. And you come up with the strategy that we have now where, we want to fill our Sable refinery with material from mines in the area. So that led us to, understanding where the material that we used to treat at Sable, where it came from. And we realized that, it actually comes from mines around Kabwe and around Bumba, and that we were buying the ores from traders. And we said, why don't we own the mine? Why don't we make sure that we can operate this in a responsible way, in line with what world-class standards look like from a mining operation? And we started looking around, and the first mine that I walked into was actually Munkoyo. And that was where we've been buying a lot of material from Munkoyo over the last 2-3 years and treating it at Sable. And the rest is history. We've now decided that, we want to own the resource. We want to operate the mines to make sure that we can demonstrate that it's been done responsibly in a way that you can say is not just environmentally responsible, but also from a community point of view, makes a huge difference.
Yeah. So I guess it was a case of that Jubilee was always the processor. It had the skills there of the Jubilee way. But the main part after that was, you'd hone those skills, but was really to shore up your own supply of run of mine. And that, I guess that's where Project G and Project M came in.
Absolutely. And that's the mining side of it. For example, Project G, we will actually be upgrading the run of mine at the mine itself and be transporting the concentrate to Sable to make cathode from that. The other one is that if you look at our DMS plant in Indola, the Rowan plant, the feed source for that is not mine. That is actually low-grade stockpiles. That is, and there's like 1.3 billion tons of that in Zambia alone.
Yeah.
And the DMS plant is the perfect way to upgrade that material because it uses physics before you put acid to it. Because a lot of these low-grade stockpiles and even some of the tailings dams doesn't economically make sense to just throw all of it into acid because it just consumes too much acid. So the DMS plant allows us to concentrate the material using physics, and then we take that concentrate and apply either acid or glycine to it to get the copper out.
Good. So obviously we're heading up now on the dirt track to Munkoyo, and we'll report back exactly what we see from site. So here we are on site at Project Munkoyo, and what we can see in the distance is effectively what you would say is the legacy mine, which looks like almost vertical shear. So just talk the listener through what we're seeing at the forefront here with the new benching.
Yeah, so what happened in the past was the miners didn't have the money or the right equipment or the right mine designs, and so they were chasing the copper vein to make cash. What we are doing now is we're building a world-class open pit mining operation where you have the pushbacks where we push the waste back. And by the way, what we call waste at Munkoyo is anything between 0.5 and 1% of copper. So we're doing a pushback on the waste so that we can open up the ore zone or the reef that you can see there at the bottom. So you can mine that for the next bench down, at least 12 to 15 meters down of ore, and then we'll do a further pushback to open it up again. So you can see on the front there, we are hauling all what we call low-grade material into one stockpile over there. That stockpile's got about 350,000 tons on it already. And we are working on a leaching process that we will actually be able to leach on-site here, the low-grade material.
So you're happy that the sulfides from here will make a good concentrate once they've been leached?
Oh, totally. So we've tested this, and as I said, you know, we've actually been treating this material through Sable for the last 2.5 years. And we've taken multiple bulk samples. We've actually, our last 2 months of production has come from...
So you know the sort of the geology, yeah, and all the chemistry of effectively the ore that's coming, yeah, out because you've been working with it for 2 years.
Yeah.
So from this 350,000 tons that is ahead of us here, even at 0.5%, how much contained copper is in this, in the low grade stuff?
350,000 times 0.05. If you run a basic leaching process on that, or you can get a 70% recovery.
So this is a great resource in itself, and without the high grade stuff that's going to be coming out of it.
Yeah.
But is it a case of wait until the end to do this, or
no,
you're going to have the leaching on site in the next period of time?
Totally. We are actually doing tests at the moment to work out what it needs to look like so that we can do it on site here in the next couple of months. And as we mine the high grade, our high grade goes, you know, anything 3-5% that we direct all to Sable at the moment, put through our leaching plant.
It's a copper question in general more than anything. But in Chile, they're creating huge mines based on 0.3, 0.4, 0.5% copper. Why, when the copper grade is so high here?
Well, that's what they have. And, you know, I think the mining industry there have been able to build businesses on 0.3. And my, to be honest, 0.3 is a high grade in Chile. So they're building those mines, and it's massive, massive volumes that they push through. The thing is, these mines are here. And the challenge is, and I think this is where Jubilee's advantage is, this is all oxide and sulfide material combined. And not a lot of people have the skills and the ability to treat it to make money, because a lot of companies will mine this and then they throw acid at it. But because some of these consume so much acid, you cannot make money out of it. So you've got to find the right processing methodologies to be able to use physics to only throw acid at the pieces that will make you money. And you float other parts that you can sell as a sulfide. And that's where I think it really is like light years ahead of a lot of companies, because we have that really deep skill on the processing side.
So when this resource is leached, it will obviously increase from 0.5% copper to a higher concentrate. So what is the hope then that concentration level will go to?
That depends basically on how long we want to leach it and what we'll be using. We want to steer towards things like glycine that is environmentally a lot more, it's actually very, very environmentally sensitive or sensible to use. And we'll be able to upgrade it to a concentrate that will, you know, maybe it goes to like 40% copper. And we take that to Sable and put it into our electrowinning plant there and make cathode from that. So it really, as I also said earlier, that we want to find ways to minimize our exposure to diesel and logistic costs. So that's why you want to find ways to leach on site in an environmentally sensitive way that will then allow us to transport way, way, way less material and still make a lot more copper.
So here we are. We are now on the Project Moncoyo's lodgings with Rick. Just talk us through what we're looking at, really, and the rationale behind why you decided to build this lodgings.
Well, firstly, this mine's going to be here for 10 to 15 years. So, and, you know, from day one, we said we wanted our workforce to live in decent conditions and not, you know, like you would find in a lot of places where people really don't look after the workforce. And so we decided that there's a huge opportunity to build a camp like this with all the local material. So the other really big benefit that we bring is that we are teaching the locals how to build something like this. We're putting in solar panels, we're putting in electricity, things that people are not used to in these rural parts of Zambia. But the other part is that we are building this with local material, and it will be sustainable for a very long time. And at the end of the mine, we will hand this back to the community.
To the community, yeah, so they can benefit from it as well.
Run it as a lodge or something like
that. So not only are you bringing, you know, the jobs to the area, you're also bringing, as I say, a whole wealth of education to educate the locals and your staff to how to be able to build this sort of sustainable lodge.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's amazing if you talk to the locals, the skills that they've been learning from people like Rian and them, you know, you can see the awakening when they realize, oh, you can actually do this stuff. You know, you don't, yeah, don't have to live in a mud hut.
Absolutely. And we also, on the way in, we passed a local school as well. Just tell us about some of the work that you're helping those, the local education and the local communities.
Yeah, so Kabanga School is about 2 kilometers from the mine. And when we first came past it, stopped at the school, and I spoke to the headmaster, and he said they really in need of running water. They also, the school was not painted, it was just a cement structure. So we put some money in, and we also put some of our own labor in there, and we painted the school. We put in a borehole for them, a soda pump, and tanks, so now they've got running water. And we'll be putting in compost toilets as well. And the other thing with the compost toilets is that we're actually going to use it as a coaching opportunity to show locals how to build these compost toilets, that they can then put that in place for their communities as well. Because like 95% of people don't have access to sanitary or sanitation in this corridor.
Which is a big problem for things like cholera and other diseases, isn't it?
Yeah.
So from there, we headed then up to see Rowan, and we met Alex, the technical manager on site, and this is what we had to say. We're heading up now from Kabwe up to Rowan, and it's been about 18 months since we were last at site, and looking forward to seeing really how much of things have changed. What do you remember from Rowan last time, Kev?
It's a very big area, and yeah, the processing plants were there, but not working at that stage. For various reasons, I think. So, everything's supposed to be in operation now. So, let's see. Already, I can see bigger things than here the last time. So, as we're just going on up the hill now to the different places.
Okay, so here we are at site of Alex Mwanza, the technical manager for Rowan site. Just talk us through what we're looking at exactly here, Alex. We're seeing a big machine. I believe it's a DMS, but just go through exactly the process and the full sort of meaning of the DMS.
All right. This is the DMS stands for Dense Media Separator. What this does is it separates the minerals based on their density. Usually a mineral is hosted in a rock, which we call a gangue. So that gangue has a density which is different from the density of the mineral. In this case, we are talking about copper minerals. Typically, the copper minerals oxide, for that matter, will be in the 3+ range, whereas the gangue, which was that mineral, will be in the 2.8 and below. So what this machine does is that you are able to set a media at a density in between these two. And by doing this, they will be separated based on their density. But then, to enhance this at a faster rate, we use a cyclone. The underflow from the cyclone, which will be the heavy amount particle, will be captured separately, and it comes and reports to this belt. And by doing that, you've separated it from the other material, which will be captured on a different belt. So that's how we're able to separate between the gangue and the mineral. The importance of the DMS is you can operate with very low grades and be able to upgrade. Like in this case, we could upgrade by, say, 10 times the grade. You start with, that means like if you are started with, say, 2%, I can go to as high as 20%, even 25. So that's the beauty about this machine. And there's no chemistry involved. It's just physics. And we say physics is always cheaper than chemistry. No chemicals involved, just the properties of the minerals themselves.
So absolutely, yeah. And most of the material that's coming here is basically going to be the oxides with a small amount of sulfides in. So you straight away, you know, once you've got the metal separated, that you're going to put that into leaching, right?
Exactly. Yeah, the ore which we are anticipating to be getting is rich in oxide. So once we've separated the gangue from the mineral, that mineral will be rich in oxide, as you have put it. And the route for that in terms of copper recovery is through leach, solvent extraction, and EW to make cathodes. So that's the processing route for now. There are many ways, but that's what we're going to do for now.
So just talk us through what we're going to go and look at next on site.
Oh, yeah. So this is just part of the Rowan plant. The Rowan plant has got, the main part of the Rowan plant is actually the concentrator, a conventional concentrator, which has got a crushing, milling, and flotation circuit, and dewatering. So that's the part we are going to look at, which is up there on top of the where we're going to after this.
Okay, so here we are, Alex, at the Rowan concentrate. Just talk us through the process of from the ore going up onto those conveyors through into, obviously, flotation, and just talk us through the byproducts that you're getting here.
All right, thank you very much. So what we're seeing from far off there are the crushers, which receive the runoff mine. Once that material is crushed, it is conveyed through the conveyor system into the silos. The silos are the equipment which stores material in readiness for feeding into the mills, as you can see from there. You feed the mill's job is now to crush further the material to liberated size. Liberation here means now you separate the waste and the copper-bearing minerals, although in the same media, but they are separated, they are no longer intertwined physically. That now material is ready, both in size and the fact that it's separated, to be fed into the flotation. In the flotation, we add chemicals. Those chemicals are able to pick the sulfide minerals and leave out the gun. So that's the science which happens there. And it's a two-stage of flotation circuit. It makes the sulfide concentrate and the oxide concentrate. So we start with the sulfide. Sulfide typically is easy to float. So we take out the sulfide using the chemical specifically amenable for sulfide minerals. We take out the sulfide minerals and we're able to make a grade of as high as 30%, 35%, depending on the mineral we start with. So that is ready for the market. The tailings or the waste product after you've taken out the sulfide is now rich in oxide. So that we channel it to the oxide, the flotation circuit. So from there, we again use almost the same principle, but different chemicals are suitable for the sulfide. We float out the oxide, and which we are able to send to our next processing route at our plant in Kabwe.
And that'll be used to upgrade and produce the cathode.
Yes, that will now go through the process to come out as a cathode. Yes. So through the process of leaching, followed by solvent extraction, and then electrowinning, which is the final process to make the cathode.
Yeah. And from the ore, come the run of mine coming in up the conveyors, what is the approximate time it takes to actually get a product or the two products at the end?
Roughly, that would be about 1 hour by the time you start feeding the material before the final concentrate drops off to the ground. I would say roughly about 1 hour. That is informed by the throughput you are doing. So I'm talking about maximum throughput here.
Yeah, and what's the maximum amount output of the plant now in terms of tonnage?
Yeah, this plant is designed to do 100 tons per hour.
Well, thank you. Thanks for showing us around. It's been, it's good to see how things have changed in the last 18 months here. And obviously, with the DMS in place, bigger concentrators and different flotation units, it certainly looks like it's expanding at quite a rate.
Yeah, definitely. That's our feeling, and we are very enthusiastic to take it to the next level.
Yeah, just talk us through how important it is that you recently shored up the energy deal with Lucemfwa Hydro for obviously, constant power, and also the potential 10 megawatt solar that was announced as well.
Yeah, that is key. That is key because we were losing our uptime by 50%. So you can just from the off, if you're able to run for two times longer than you were running, that's a plus. It has enabled us to be able to run the two circuits, the DMS, as well as the conventional concentrator at the same time. So it's a big thing. It's a big thing. It has really changed our...
Yeah. Operation. So you can pretty much run 24/7 unhindered without any interruptions.
Oh, yes, we can. We can right now, yes.
Well, thanks for showing us around, Alex. It's been a real eye-opener.
Thank you very much. You're welcome.
And then obviously we wouldn't come all this way to Zambia without catching up with the main man himself. We obviously spoke to Leon Kurtzer as well at the end of the week, and this is what Leon had to say.
Yeah, and we also reached out to Leon Kurtzer, CEO of Jubilee Metals, this week for comment, and here's what he had to say. Welcome back to the podcast, Leon. How's things?
Oh, thanks, Phil. Those doing well, thank you. And I'm really happy that you've been able to take the time to go and see our operations in Zambia.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, obviously, want to first off start by saying a huge thank you for arranging the site visit and obviously for your incredible hospitality. A special shout out to Rickus and Alex, obviously, who we just heard from earlier in the podcast, for kindly showing us around Munkoyo and Rowan. So let's dive into Zambia. I mean, it's been a few years since you kicked off operations there, and it would be great if you could just give our listeners an overview of how far you've come and your vision for the future. I mean, we've been hearing a lot about this ambitious 3 million metric tons copper strategy, which aims to significantly boost Zambia's copper production to that 3 million tons annually by 2031. Just how pivotal a role will Jubilee play in helping the country achieve those numbers?
No, absolutely, Phil. So if you look at our strategy, how we approach this opportunity was first and foremost, as you've probably seen in Zambia, infrastructure is challenging in Zambia. So first and foremost, what we would set out to do was to secure a processing footprint and expand that processing footprint. And that has come to fruition with our Rowan concentrator, both front, the new front-end module and the flotation circuit now operational, Sable currently being expanded as a processing footprint that we exceed comfortably the 25,000 tons per annum of copper. The next phase, which I'm so glad that you were able to go and see, is now slotting in as we bring into production the various resources we've secured. Rowan has commenced with its waste rock processing. Rowan and, of course, Sable with the likes of Munkoyo, where we're bringing these operations rapidly into its production and expanding those operations. We now full that 25,000 tons of copper. And that's just the start. That doesn't mean that we end at 25,000 tons. It purely says that that is the first key milestone we've set out for the country. And we're demonstrating to Zambia what can be done rapidly, and investing into surface material and investing into these open pit opportunities we're securing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's always been about the processing side, you know, Jubilee, the Jubilee way, the way you can go along, you can analyze the run of mine or whatever it is, you know, the ore, and say, okay, you want to do it this way, you need to do flotation or leaching or whatever it is, and you can produce concentrates and all your cathodes. But just how important was it that you needed to shore up the likes of Project M, the other projects around, and also things like the, you know, the significant Muffalera slag projects? You know, you seem to have amassed a massive amount of run of mine over the last sort of, you know, 8 to 12 months. Just how significant is it? You know, how you should never really underestimate the importance of that.
Oh, absolutely, Phil. I mean, if you look at the projections coming out from BHP, just came out with their projections of copper. Copper is set to be in a significant shortfall for to meet the demands of the world. And if you do not secure your resources now, you would miss the opportunity come 12 months down the line. Because at that stage, the cost and the value of copper resources will truly be reflected in the market. And that's what we are doing. We are securing opportunistically resources in this market, which is overlooked by most companies because they do not have that processing capability. And that is why we so aggressively have built up this resource portfolio, as you say, that we can bring into operation. And we're not done yet. There's still a number of opportunities that we are targeting to secure to be ready for that increase in copper demand, which is projected by so many companies, analysts, and people.
So, Leanne, it was really very interesting to go to Kabwe, just so people understand. We obviously went to the plant in Kabwe, but didn't really stop and look. And then onto Munkoyo, which is about 40 minutes now with the new road, and you've also built, you're going to be building a new bridge there from containers, which we also saw, which will also cut 16 kilometers off that trip, which is obviously going to be beneficial.
And what we had a moment, didn't we, where we lost the wheel.
I'm coming to that bit now, and basically it's obviously going to have helped the local community as well. We can see that the local communities is good. Now, what I want to ask you is, did you check the nuts on our car that was coming to Kabwe? Because our wheel actually fell off on the way to Munkoyo. Literally fell off.
Yeah, that's a good actually example of the kind of infrastructure that you have to make work to have these opportunities turn into production. You just mentioned it. To get Munkoyo, you know, we make an announcement in the market that says Munkoyo's become, you know, is operational and starting to deliver its first tons, and that goes out into the market. Very few people, unlike yourself, actually visiting the facility to understand what goes into making that statement. What means the road infrastructure, the bridge infrastructure, the community engagement and projects you have to launch, never mind the development of the Munkoyo project itself. That all comes into play to actually make a statement that Munkoyo has commenced delivering mined material to Sable to make cathode. And in that process, yes, you might have the unfortunate incident of losing a wheel while the new road is being commissioned. But I'm glad that it happened there, where things are at least safe and slow.
Yeah, absolutely. If it happened on the main road, you wouldn't be speaking to us now, I don't think. So we felt very blessed that it happened going about 15 kilometers an hour. So, yeah, and then just so people understand, we went to Munkoyo. It's obviously partially through, wrong to say desert, but savannah land, if you like. And then you arrive in Munkoyo. It's tree lined. And then we saw all the infrastructure that's now being put up there. And, you know, would imagine in a year's time that's going to be a totally functioning mine with all the miners' accommodation, and obviously Jubilee responsibly are going to try and house the miners in a good way, as well as the workers who are coming from Kabwe that need to do the things. And what we also saw, which was very interesting, was the amount of waste material that you have there as well, because it's huge. And, you know, Rickus was explaining to us that probably going to have some sort of leaching equipment on there, and basically you'll be able to create a concentrate straight from Monkoya.
Yes, very much so. I mean, there's a couple of points you made there. First and foremost is exactly when you invest into these remote opportunities, as we have, you have to ensure that you bring your community along. You have to ensure that, and that's a statement we made up front, we were not going to build tents for our workers to live in, but instead build lodges for our workers to be housed comfortably in the area that they work. And yes, you are right, Munkoyo's opportunity is vast. Beyond the material that we are high-grading direct to Sable, we are building up an extremely large stockpile of lower-grade material at Munkoyo, and our processing and technical team is completing that design now of how do we extract that copper at Munkoyo to produce a high-grade product, which is then refined to final metal at Sable. And that is already planned, as you probably sure showed, for the very near term to be implemented at Munkoyo, which takes Munkoyo to another level of production if you compare it to the actual investment we made to secure that opportunity.
Yeah, and what we saw also, and we discussed it with the guys there as well, you know, they're obviously creating a facility there, washing facilities, cooking facilities. They're going to be having, chickens. They're going to be having animals. They're going to plant some, they already have planted some trees, I think, you know, for fruit and citrus and stuff like this. Obviously, because it's a plan for the next 10 years at least. From what Rick has also said to us that, you know, it's interesting. We talk to mining companies all the time, and it's, have you got the JORC? Have you got this? Have you got that? Have you gone through a pre-feasibility study? Well, actually, a lot of these smaller ones in Zambia, it's almost just not worth doing any of this. So nobody understands the true value. So, you know, from what Rick was saying, you've overflown the place with magnetics. And it looks like it could potentially be three times the size it is now, moving out of the pit. So, you know, it could really be something that could last a lot longer than even anybody anticipates.
Yeah, very much. And that's the opportunity we saw, Kevin, is that when we fly and we analyze the material and we have the luxury of our operating plants to actually process and accurately determine the recoverability and processes required to extract that copper, it gave a real impression to our group on the sheer potential magnitude that Munkoyo could be. And you're right. The fact that the reef is at surface and therefore it's visible, your risk of investment is dramatically reduced because you know that you're not betting on whether there is copper. You can physically see the copper in the ground. The continuity of that copper is what we then focus on. And that's the drill program currently happening. And there's two drivers for that drill program, as you accurately say. One is to ensure that we actually get a better understanding of the sheer potential size of that operation, because that gives us a driver of how big should we make Munkoyo for the day-to-day operational side. But also there's a driver to inform our investors of what is the resource quality that we've secured. And that is important for your company's balance sheet to actually show that this is the quality of resource that you have secured and proven up through your drilling program. And that's what currently is happening at Munkoyo as well.
Yeah, because I think we don't really know how deep it goes either, do we?
No, we know that we've drilled it to a certain depth. We've only gone down to about 80 meters at the moment, and there's copper all the way. So how deep it goes beyond that, we haven't drilled further. At the moment, the continuity of that reef allows us the luxury to not have to go particularly deep on that pit development. But that's something for the future and a real potential for the future.
Yeah, and just so people understand, because I didn't really understand this myself until we came, your operations in South Africa, you don't own the resource, so you don't own the asset. So really, you're only getting a part of the game, if you like, because you're getting the toll treatment and that's where you're making your money. And that's been very profitable and very good. But in this particular instance now in Zambia, you're going to own the whole game. from literally digging it out of the ground to it becoming a copper cathode. And I even said to Rickus, why don't you make something with it? You know, why don't Jubilee make something with it? You know, you could go the whole way. And therefore, you are completely de-risking the whole situation, because now you will be at nobody's mercy. It will be just you.
Quite correct, Kevin. I mean, that's something we said before, is that the lessons we learned in South Africa is through our processing skill, and we invested an enormous amount of R&D and investment cost into developing that processing knowledge and the IP we have in the processing. And in South Africa, we apply that, as you say, to other people's, and therefore the benefit is shared. And by the time we had illustrated our ability on those reefs, it had valued those reefs drastically, where they were valued right at the beginning at very little value. And that's a lesson we learned in South Africa and that we corrected in Zambia, is that we upfront securing the resource so that the benefit of our processing ability, our processing knowledge and our IP is secured for the Jubilee investor. And that is, as you accurately identify, the key difference in how we're approaching the rollout of the Zambian strategy on the back of the success in South Africa.
Yeah, I can say to people listening as well that Rickus is very switched on. You will have heard him already. And he really is looking for every opportunity to create value within the Jubilee system and the Jubilee assets that are available. So it really was very interesting for us to see. And then obviously we moved on to Rowan.
I'll ask you something on Rowan as well while we're moving on to it. Obviously, we went to site and we've spoken to Alex, has been on earlier on the podcast. But I just wanted to say how important, could you just stress to listeners just how important the having the DMS on site is, and the fact that you can effectively feed multiple feed sources of, you know, copper oxide and sulfide simultaneously, which is going to increase Rowan's copper output to sort of 13,000 tons per annum. So just how important was it having this DMS in this cyclone on site now, Leon?
Yeah, absolutely, Phil. So what Rowan is a demonstration of is the ability to put down a processing facility that is able to process a variety of material simultaneously. Previously, Rowan, we had to selectively process and recover a component of the copper that was secured. And Rowan is a prelude for what we plan to implement on our very large waste rock project that we had secured. So what this front end of Rowan is demonstrating is exactly as you say. We can simultaneously feed waste from tailings as well as waste from mining or low-grade rock from mining simultaneously to that facility and concentrate up and produce simultaneously an oxide and a sulfide concentrate. It opens up the whole spectrum of waste and surface low-grade materials that have piled up over the many, many years in Zambia to such a facility. And now we have an ability to show that industrial scale that actually is a precursor to what is planned at our waste rock project, where we're sitting with 260 million tons on surface, 20, 30 years of feed material sitting on surface. And that's where Rowan is so fundamentally important, not only just for demonstrating what we can do on these materials, but also showing the industry that these materials can be extracted and extracted successfully.
Yeah. And also I want to just highlight the importance of the fact that you secured the Lucemfoir hydro agreement in place, obviously the company. I mean, that should never be. I mean, we've been sat in hotel rooms, you know, over this last few days, power's cutting out, load shedding's going, we're trying to cross the road, there's no light system, it's chaotic, you know. And if you're trying to rely on that for, you know, companies trying to run cafes and restaurants, it's almost impossible. But just explain how significant it is that you've shored up this energy and also the solar element of things going forward.
Our full fundamental. I'm so glad that you're there experiencing it firsthand. Yeah, because again, often in messaging, when you're speaking to a shareholder base, which is used to flicking a switch and the lights come on, when you're trying to operate in a country where we've gone through a period where there has been absolutely no power security and the power availability has been so erratic, and you're trying to run a process that is fundamentally based on stability to make quality copper. And therefore, the absolute breakthrough to secure private, independent power that is supplied to our facilities consistently for 24 hours is a fundamental shift. It actually should be reevaluating the value of our copper initiative, because we are in such a unique position where 100% of our power requirements now in Zambia for both Sable and Rowan is supplied via an independent company who warrants the security of our power to our facilities. On top of that, as you say, is the fact that in parallel, there's the development of the solar power facility to ensure that as we're now expanding Sable and hope to expand into our waste rock project, that those power demands can also be met and importantly brings down our power cost rather than the emergency power rates that are being offered to the industry at the moment in Zambia. It's a fundamentally important shift that was secured by the leadership in Zambia.
Yeah, we also talked to Rickerson, and there is obviously the opportunity at Rowan, and maybe not even just with Rowan, at the power company to actually do some sort of solar. I mean, ultimately, why this country doesn't have huge amounts of solar, I have no idea, because obviously the sun shines quite a lot in Zambia. So that obviously must be a way forward for you as well, the solar route.
Yeah, very much so, Kevin. And that's why the project is being pursued aggressively with us and our power supplier, where we're looking to, in a 14-month period, ramping up that solar power to more than 10 megawatts of solar power to complement what we currently have. And you're right, the sun shines the most during the dry season in Zambia, and that's when the hydropower is at its lowest. So there's a beautifully complementary power supply scenario in Zambia between solar and hydro that is on offer.
Yep. So obviously, if you have listened to a podcast during the week with Leon, you will have seen the results. So we will be talking about those in the other podcast. So if you want to listen to those, please do a fuller view of those results. But just for everybody who didn't listen to that, Leon, give us an overview of the results from last year.
Oh, thanks, Kevin. Yes, I mean, the results, it's released, it really demonstrates a few key principles of Jubilee. One is the importance of our diverse metal portfolio. If you roll the clock back 3 years, our earnings were dominated by platinum group metals. If that was still the case today, our earnings and our EBITDA of our group would have plummeted by more than 60-odd%, as most PGM companies have announced earnings that reduced by more than 80-odd%. Instead, what we announced as a group is a company that has grown its revenue despite the sharp pullback in PGMs. And we were able to grow our revenues because we progressively increased our chrome component of our business, which was a brilliant performance by that team led by Bertus in South Africa to up the chrome production by yet another 22% for the year, with revenues following suit on chrome to offset the sharp pullback in PGMs. Then, and of course, what the results show is the emergence of copper, as copper EBITDA growing significantly yet again this year, growing by more than 70%. It's still at low numbers, but now set with the completion of Rowan, Sable expanding, ready to grow yet another significant percentage for the coming year as copper now steps up. So if you look at the group results, EBITDA reduced by only 7% when PGMs itself crashed by nearly 40-odd%, thanks to the buffering effect of our chrome business performing so well and expanding. And of course, that is not as if the chrome business has reached its full capacity. As we told the market, two further modules are currently being implemented for chrome, set to come into operation in November. So one can expect the chrome to step up yet again in the coming year, which is a fundamental shift for our group. And copper, as you've seen our guidance, set to increase by more than 70-odd% in production if we meet our guidance, a minimum of the low side of our guidance for the coming period. So overall, a result that demonstrates increase in chrome production, significant increase in copper production, despite the challenges that the team had to overcome in Zambia, and now I've set the foundation with constant power, expanded processing facilities. So really setting up for a good year that lies ahead.
Yeah, and I think just to illustrate to people that why you're so forcibly going for the copper, last year you had a overall revenue of $207 million. If you achieve the 25,000 tons of contained copper processed, that's a revenue of $250 million at 10,000. So I just want to say that to put it in perspective of how big a deal the Zambia thing is going to be. Now, I don't fully expect it to be a 25,000 this time next year. Maybe you do, but I don't. The reality is that things take time. But I think if you make a big step, and I can see that that's probably going to happen, and then the following year, I think maybe you will exceed 25,000 tons per annum in the copper side of things if all goes to plan. But yeah, I just want to show people that the copper is going to eventually be a much bigger addition to the company's profitability than the chrome, because that 207 million produced 27 point something million dollars of EBITDA. The copper is likely to produce 100 million from the 250 million because your margins are so much bigger because of what we've discussed, that you've got the mine, you've got the ore, you've got the processing, and then you'll sell the cathodes at more than LME. So yeah, well done. It's going to happen, I'm pretty sure. It looks very exciting.
Well, thanks, Kevin. I mean, that was the key that I'm so glad you guys experienced firsthand in your trip to Zambia, is we have the right leadership in place. We have the right assets in our processing capacity, and we have the right resources we're bringing into production at the moment. So the ingredients are correct for success.
So 5 years from now, can you see 100,000 tons of contained copper being produced?
Well, what I can say is that if we look at the opportunity set we're chasing, that opportunity set, how much of that opportunity set we'll grab is a debate, but we are certainly aggressively grabbing a significant portion of it. But the opportunity set we're chasing has the potential, as we've said before, to produce more than 300,000 tons of copper per annum alone.
Yeah, I have no doubt. And if you did that, you know, you would become a major almost, I would suggest, in terms of the size of the business and the profitability of the business. And that is without what I think everybody sees, is that the copper price is going higher.
Correct. I mean, the fundamentals of copper is superb at the moment. You know, every time copper pulls back, it's so short and reacts immediately back up, testing the high $9,000 and $10,000 per ton of copper. And when you see the notes coming out from your big copper producers and your analysts at the moment, there's one consistent theme, and that is that there just isn't enough copper being produced to meet the demands.
Indeed.
Okay. Well, on that note, we'll say
thank you.
Absolute pleasure again, as I say, and thanks for your team's hospitality and for arranging it all, because it was a real eye-opener.
Oh, excellent. Thank you, Phil. I'm so pleased that you guys took the time to come and see.
Yeah, next year we'll come and see South Africa again, and then we will come hopefully to see one or two or three or however many mines you managed to sort out.
Yeah, let's hope it's more than that.
Okay,
so let's have a look at some of the movers and shakers of the week. The best performer was Tower Resources. That was up some 158% after interim results highlighting good prospects in Cameroon and Namibia. And we also saw Energy Pathways that we just talked about at the top of the show there. They were up some 65 to 67%. Obviously, they secured the £5.1 million green loan facility from Global Green Asset Financing for the Marram Energy Storage Hub project. We obviously caught up with Ben Clude this week, and here's what he had to say. So Energy Pathways has secured a £5.1 million green loan facility from Global Green Asset Financing, GGAF, for its Marram Energy Storage Hub MESH project, a large-scale natural gas and green hydrogen storage facility. The loan will fund the project through the FEED phase, targeting FID, final investment decision, by the end of 2025. The facility offers flexible, minimally diluted financing with interest at 12.5% annually and repayment options. MESH is located off the Lancashire coast, will initially store 15 terawatt hours of energy with plans to triple its capacity. Energy Pathways aims to strengthen its leading position in the UK energy storage sector. So could you tell us more about how this funding will be used, specifically for the FEED phase, and what it means for the project's development, please, Ben?
Yes, so this funding is to support the MESH project's progress towards FID, which we're targeting for the end of 2025. And it'll cover the array of studies and work streams going with FEED, working with our strategic partnership group, who are a number of top-tier companies. And through that, we'll be finalising the facilities design and the storage production profiles, withdrawal rates, injection rates, to get us to a well-defined storage facility project.
Okay, I mean, that sounds really, really positive news, Ben. But so with that FEED phase now funded, what are the next key milestones for the mesh project? I assume that, you know, you'll be looking at a timeline and aiming to reach a final investment decision by the end of 2025, presumably?
Look, there's an array of milestones coming up for the project. And what we need to do is, with that, those are some announcements with respect to our Tier 1 strategic partnership groups as we bring those partnerships into fruition. It'll also be announcements in relation to offtake arrangements for the storage capacity within the project and offtake of gas production. And also we'll be looking at announcements with respect to the renewable power connection that we'll be having with the wind farms in the region as well. There'll also be updates on the storage licensing process that we're progressing, and also our progress towards hydrogen production and storage.
So Ben, cracking deal, I have to say. We haven't seen as good a deal as this on the market for quite a while, I think. So congratulations. I think to get funding in this way is obviously very beneficial for the company and obviously the shareholders involved in the project.
Yeah, that's right. I think you know, we're very pleased with this financing arrangement for our shareholders. It's effectively a non-dilutive financing structure, and that was something that we wanted to achieve. I think our ability to achieve this sort of financing arrangement for the company and for our shareholders is due to the approach that we're taking in the energy transition space, and we're able to attract clean tech financing type structures, and we've seen a fair amount of interest in what we're doing. So, yeah, we appeal to the clean tech and green financing space, and we're having other discussions in relation to that. So we've had quite a lot of interest, so we're very pleased.
Okay, also this week we caught up with James Short, Jim, from Celadon. They had some more good news this week. Another contract win, valuing, I think, about £10.5 million. Which obviously is now going to be supplied by the Dutch company that they have involved themselves in. And there was also a very interesting announcement on Friday that on the 22nd of October, there is a visit available to all shareholders and the like to go to the place in the Midlands to go and see the Celadon setup. And as I was there last summer, I can strongly recommend that you go and see it, because then I think you'll be convinced that this really is a company that's going to go places.
And, yeah, it's touted as an investor site visit, isn't it? So it's open to, obviously, investors. And I think not just existing, you know, but potentially new investors as well, right? So if anybody wants to join in that, they can obviously have a look on the Celadon Pharma website or just look at the RNS, and there's instructions there on how to register for the attendance. So I'm going to try and get up there on the 22nd as well. And there'll be a few other people accompanying me, so it should be a good visit.
And this is what Jim had to say during the week.
We've just seen the news that the company has signed a five-year sales contract worth up to £10.5 million with a newly established healthcare company for the supply of medicinal cannabis from its UK facility. The contract includes minimum order volumes with cultivation for the first year starting within 12 months. This follows Celadon's September 2024 collaboration with Valios Pharma, allowing Celadon to supply European customers from Denmark, reducing administrative burden and increasing UK capacity. With this deal, Celadon's order book potential reaches £40.7 million, and the company is in talks to secure further agreements. Sounds very promising, Jim. Please just add a bit of colour to this.
Yeah, and I just want to pick up, Phil, on your comment that, you know, it's a newly formed company that we've signed with. Actually, this company's been around in different guises for many years. And when we sign a supply agreement, it doesn't just happen overnight. You know, we've been talking to this company for probably 5 months now. So again, we're super excited about it. But, you know, we have a lot of comments from people saying, great, another order, are you going to supply? Well, hopefully now they understand that we can now supply through our Valios partnership. which gives us access to, you know, much more capacity. But the other key part to it, Phil, is because we're now building on our orders, it's helping us when we're talking to debt investors. Because debt money back in the last year was hard to access. Now it's getting a little bit easier. And the fact that we can now demonstrate to lenders that we have orders, we have capacity, we're getting revenue, we're starting to see, I don't want to say fantastic rates from debt investors, but we're starting to see a little bit better rates and debt investors talking to us. And we actually have two or three of those that we've been working with for several months now that will allow us to access debt to then further bring on capacity in our existing facility. So fantastic win for us. You know, it's great. And we've got a number of others in the pipeline of orders that we're fetching that we'll be bringing on in due course. So great win for the team, really.
So, Jim, if you fulfill this, I think it was £42 million worth of orders, what is the sort of gross profit on that for Celadon?
Yeah, so that there's two answers to that, Kev. The one is the gross profit for us is a lot higher if it's in our facility. We're up at 70s. This one today will be a little bit less than that because we have to give our partners some of that in Denmark. So really, on an average, we'll probably get around that 55 to 60% margin as a spread from our UK facility and our Danish partners.
Okay, so basically what you're saying is we're sitting at, if we supply all of these orders, we're sitting at somewhere in the region of £20 million gross profit around thereabouts.
Correct, correct.
Maybe slightly higher, but let's say it's that sort of figure. And you have a current market cap of £16.5 million. So how do you feel about that?
Obviously not good, especially being one of the largest shareholders. It's not good, but you know, as most of my peers that I speak to and I listen to on podcasts, the, you know, Bezos come out with a classic one of the share price isn't the business and the business isn't the share price, just keep delivering on what you're delivering. And ironically, Kev, we are delivering far more than what we even said we'd do when we IPO'd, and our share price were at 165. You know, it's not good, but we've just got to keep head down, and I've got to keep the team's morale up and keep going. And more importantly, keep getting the support from our shareholders, really. And hopefully they'll look back at this in 3 years' time and go, wow, you know,
yeah, that won't was
be right. But
yeah, that was quite a ride. So, you know, to go back to people who don't really know or haven't listened to this story so far, you raised some money at 40p recently. That gives you a runway for the rest of this year, from what you said. And then your financial director has said he's resigning and leaving at the end of the year. And the share price pretty much went down by like 40, 50% for no particular reason. So do you want to add any colour to that?
I wouldn't say for no particular reason. I think shareholders have thought, hang on, CFO knows more what's going on in the company, why is he leaving? But actually, his resignation has got nothing to do with the company. It really hasn't. It's his personal reasons why he's left. He's a great guy. You know, I still admire him. He's a really good guy. And a lot of people have had a bit of a go at him, why are you jumping out now? But personal reasons are personal reasons, and that's why he's left. And yes, we probably could have mentioned in the RNS about his personal, but it's personal. There's a word why it's called personal. So it's for him to make that decision. I actually didn't push hard to try and keep him here, offering more money, because it doesn't change his personal reasons, especially this. So he's left. He's, you know, he's very supportive. As you said, he's still here till the end of Christmas. We had our quarterly board meeting yesterday, and our board have set a subcommittee up to get a replacement, whether that's an interim in the short period whilst we take our time to get a full-time one. We're on that journey now. We're very fortunate as a board. We've got two very strong financial people on our board. Robbie Barr is the ex-FD of Vodafone. David Firth, still regulated. He sits on a couple of AIM-listed. So we've got two good guys there that are taking a lot of, not pressure, but they'll take a lot off me in helping us find a replacement for John. So, as I say, it's not a Celadon thing. In actual fact, it's to the contrary, because John's been heavily working for the last few months with a few debt lenders that we're in advanced conversations with to bring in debt into Celadon now to drive us to our further growth. So I wish him all the very best, and, you know, he's a great guy.
Okay, so there was a newcomer to the market this week. We don't get too many IPOs happening on AIM, do we? But it is refreshing to see one. But this company works in the generative AI space, the analytics specialist GenIP, successfully listed on London's AIM market this week. Ticker is GNIP, and they raised £1.75 million in an oversubscribed fundraise. Having already achieved initial orders for its generative AI services, GenIP plans to deploy the IPO proceeds to expand sales and marketing activities. The company's board is led by Lord Willetts, president of the Resolution Foundation and chair of the UK Space Agency. And we actually managed to reach out to Melissa Cruz, the CEO, on the day of the listing, and here's what she had to say. So welcome, Melissa.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me here today.
Absolutely. So, do you want to start by telling us a bit about yourself and the background of GenIP and what inspired the company's inception, please?
Thank you. So my name is Melissa Cruz, and I'm the CEO at GenIP, as you previously introduced. And I'm very excited about the present and the future of GenIP. I've been helping companies search and acquire technologies for 7 years now. We have here a compelling story of innovation, growth, and commitment to excellence. And just to give you an overview of GenIP, GenIP provides generative artificial intelligence analytic services to help companies, research institutions, and venture funds to assess and commercialize new discoveries. And the company offers two primary services, which are Invention Evaluator and Vortex. The Invention Evaluator combines expert human technical review with GenAI algorithms to provide insightful and verified assessments of the commercialization potential of new inventions, enabling our clients to make informed decisions. To date, we have sold over 5,000 reports to more than 300 research institutions and corporations worldwide. We offer two pricing tiers. So it's the for-profit companies pay $995, while nonprofit organizations benefit from an academic discount of $799. The second complementary service is Vortex. Vortex is a headhunting service that specializes in sourcing talent to commercialize very early stage technology, focusing on roles such as technology transfer manager, IP manager, licensing associates, among other roles. We charge a flat fee rate of $15,000 per assignment, and we have completed hundreds of assignments until today. It's also good to mention that we have the same clients base for both services: large corporations, universities, government agencies, medical research institutions, and venture funds.
Okay, very good. Yeah. I mean, when we think of AI, and I guess most people's exposure to it is in the form of something like ChatGPT. GenIP operates within the generative AI space. Could you just explain what generative AI is and how your platform-based services work and what differentiates GenIP from the other AI companies?
Yes, so generative AI models are trained on large data sets and can generate unique outputs that resemble the training data but are not exact replicas. For example, text generation models like GPT-3 can produce coherent articles, stories, and even poetry. And the generative AI analytics market is experiencing rapid growth, with projections indicating it could reach approximately $200 billion by 2030. And this expansion offers a significant growth opportunity for GenIP as we position ourselves at the forefront of this technological evolution. It's also worth noting that the median pre-money valuation for seed-level generative AI startups is currently around $12 million, reflecting a strong investor confidence in the future of this market. And this valuation highlights the potential for growth in generative AI and reinforces our commitment to leveraging advanced analytics to meet the evolving needs of our clients. As we move forward, GenIP is excited about the possibilities that lie ahead of this dynamic market. And what sets us apart is that before introducing AI, we have developed in-house our own software stack to offer the best quality reports available in the market. So we pride ourselves to have the fastest report in the market for the lowest price point that you could see. So if you go to competitors, you can find similar products for thousands of dollars, and they will take weeks and months to be delivered, while our reports and our services, they take just a few business days to be delivered and for less than $1,000.
Yeah. So just kind of breaking it down for listeners, it looks like GenIP has two main services. You've got the Invention Evaluator. This service kind of looks at new technologies and provides a detailed report on
how valuable they could be. It uses AI to analyze things like maybe market trends, potential competitors, and I guess the likelihood of success. I suppose it's like having a smart assistant that can help figure out if your invention is worth investing in or how to pitch it to investors. And then you've got Vortex, which this service helps tech companies find right executives or leaders to take that new technology forward, using AI to match companies with maybe experienced business leaders who can help drive the technology to market success. So would that be a fair summation?
Yes, and I would like to give you an example of how our clients use Invention Evaluator. In the case of universities, Invention Evaluator enables universities to evaluate innovations, aiding strategic decision-making on research projects. On the case of venture firms, they leverage Invention Evaluator for in-depth analysis of technology viability, informing their investment choices. And in the case of corporations, they utilize Invention Evaluator to assess the market potential of new technologies, optimizing their R&D resource allocation and product pipelines.
Yeah, some of the shakers this week, we saw SCE, Surface Transformed, down some 75%. They had interim results and they announced that revenue had increased by 58% to 4.7 million in the first half of 2024, primarily driven by growth in OEM customer sales. Gross profit margin declined by to 56% due to increased outsourcing costs and product mix. There's no revenue recognized for work carried out on system integration services in that period as well. So that one was hammered in the week that was. Any others that you want to mention, Kev, this week?
Yeah, when you talk about hammered, I want to mention Eastar Resources. I'm really upset by this one, to be honest with you. The scenario is that Vakuba, which is VMS copper project in Kazakhstan, Alex Walker, the CEO there, had intonated through RNSs that the deal would be struck for it and then said there was delays on it. And the share price was 2.5p, somewhere like that. And there's obviously been left to drift. The deal's obviously fallen through. It's now going to raise that 1.15p, I think it is. So,
ouch.
It's like, what? What? And this is the second time this has happened. It's the second time we've gone all the way down to nearly a penny to raise funds. Huge dilution, 100 million shares on 230 million shares, I think it was. Yeah, the asset obviously hasn't changed, but the shareholder scenario has just changed drastically now. It could have been a dilution of maybe 50 million shares for the same amount of money. I don't get it. I really, really, really don't get it. And yes, I am a shareholder, fairly considerable amount of shares. And I'm very, very disappointed with how that's been handled. They're now obviously going to go and try and do it themselves, take it to the next level, and then see where it goes from there. The asset itself, I think, is good. Obviously, Eastar has a lot of other things going on with BHP, I think it is, with the grant that they have for the porphyry style deposits. But this is VMS, so they're almost like volcanic copper, where it normally is pretty high grade and at surface. So yeah, that's one. So on a more cheerful note, we look at Bazant, raised at a 59% premium to their share price during the week there, £250,000. So the share price moves up then, I think, to 3.4p. People were buying that, or not 3.3p, it's 0.03p,
yeah. It's fractional money, isn't it now?
It's fractional because there's about 11 billion shares in issue. But we're still talking about a market cap of about 2.5 to 3 million pounds, which for what they've got, certainly in the Philippines and also what they've got in Namibia, which we visited earlier in the year. Again, we're just waiting for that mining license. If it comes, we're going to get quite a result, I think, because all of a sudden that company cannot be worth that sort of value. So that was good news. Galileo also had good news on the Shinganda scenario. Again, we're going to speak, I think, with Colin early next week. So I won't talk too much about that, but it looked very interesting anyway. Shinganda, a big strike.
Yeah. Greatland Gold, talk to me.
Well, Greatland Gold, all the shares are out. It's now sitting at 6.2, 6.3p, I think it is, yep, for sure.
I mean, Charles got his opportunity, didn't he, to drop in at 4.8 as well.
Well, that hasn't happened. Yeah. Unless disaster comes upon them, that's not going to happen now, I think. I think he would openly admit that. What I would say is if Telfer and the ore that's sitting there starts producing and there's going to be a lot of cash flow coming through that company,
yeah,
within the next sort of few months, literally, then I can't see how it could stay at the valuation that it's at, to be honest. So I'm looking for double figures on this in the next number of months if the production comes from Telfer. If the cash flow starts coming from Telfer, then it has to be worth considerably more than it is now.
I mean, they say that you see on the groups quite a lot of people saying Havieron's pushed out to end of 26 now. I mean, I don't know how true that is. You know, obviously, they're going to get the working capital coming in. They're going to get a lot of cash flow coming in to do the work, the necessary work they need to do at Havieron. Maybe that will expedite the whole thing in terms of if they were just currently stuck in the same, you know, in prior to the taking the 100%. I think it's certainly accelerated it, hasn't it?
Yeah, oh no, absolutely. I mean, I think if you can make the most of Telfer and Havieron is brought forward with cash flow from Telfer, then that's obviously going to help. You don't have to borrow so much money against the Havieron asset, which is now 100% owned. You know, so they are in control of that situation, and they should really be in control of that whole Paterson area now with the main processing plant and the ability to do it. So, yeah, I mean, we'll get Sean on again, I'm sure, in the next number of weeks and see what progress they're making. The other one is GMET, Guardian Metal Resources. There was a bit of a wobble there, wasn't there? Somebody
wobbled and then it recovered to what, sort of 26, 27, was it, at the end of the week?
I think it's 27 or thereabouts at the end of the week. And building up now to more and more and more assays that are going to be coming out. And this grant has got to be coming closer and closer and closer, or at least the decision. I think it's pretty nailed on, but who knows? You know. But if that comes and a $15 million price tag was quoted on one of those printouts that we saw, then that's going to radically change the valuation in Guardian Metals. So I'm sure we're going to hear from Oliver probably next week. At some point, we will cover that, obviously, well, when and if it comes out. So, yeah.
Just a quick shout out to Incantera. They just put out a tweet. This is just an X post, just basically saying that they have now completed the product packaging, or they've announced the packaging, which you can see there. If you go onto Incantera's X post or X page, you'll see there they've got the different products there. You've got the B3 face, the B3 serum, and the B3 eye, in very, very nice sort of gold style bottles or containers, as you'd call them. Dispensers is probably more of an accurate description of them. But what do you think of that? It's quite sort of premium packaging, isn't it?
It is. It's very nice. And Suzanne, you'll be listening to this. We need some.
I actually sent her a message in the week saying, I really like the packaging, and I've run out of my previous lot. Could you possibly send some more over? She's like, yeah, as soon as I get them, they'll be there. You know, we're just waiting on them to be delivered. And we'll get them out to you. So, it's really good. Any others, Kev? I mean, we've been through quite a lot. It's a long show. Obviously, it's been a Zambia special, but we've also covered the midweek podcast that we did where you heard from, you know, obviously Gen IP, obviously heard from EPP, and then obviously we also heard from Celadon as well. So I hope you enjoyed those midweek. If you didn't catch them in their entirety, please do go onto the Sunday Roast Audio Boom page or onto X and you'll find links to those. Anything else you want to talk about?
Yeah, or you can go onto YouTube there, and we're trying to get people to follow us on YouTube there, so get following us. There'll be more stuff coming on YouTube as well in terms of videos and things which you won't catch otherwise. So, yeah.
Yeah, please do hit the subscribe and hit the bell icon for further notifications of future episodes.
Yeah, and what's been happening then? Liverpool won again in Europe. Manchester United had their captain sent off.
Had a second wobble, didn't they, there, after leading 2-0. Throw it away again.
Yeah, and your man, your Portuguese boy, threw his toys out the pram again.
Yeah.
And Aston Villa beat Bayern Munich. What a result that was. Beat Bayern Munich at home 1-0. I saw some of the Aston Villa fans being interviewed. They couldn't believe it. They were in shock. So, interesting times ahead for the Premier League, I think. Now, Rodri's out for the season for Manchester City. So it's game on. I think all of a sudden people are starting to think, Manchester City without Rodri is a different game. So it could be entertaining this season. Manchester City, Arsenal, Liverpool, by the looks of things, in the top three. Though, I don't think you can completely write off Chelsea. They seem to be, especially with Cole Palmer scoring for fun, you never know.
Good.
So, yeah.
Okay, well, I think we've talked enough. And as I say, if you like what you heard, please do subscribe and follow us on all the different social media channels and media platforms. And from we'll sign off from Zambia and say thanks very much for listening.
Thank you.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net.